Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
So much fun off the microphone. You guys would love to hear some of the stuff that Benji says. Anyway, I am Tom Marshall. Hello. And it has been a pleasure this season to be your time traveling show Sherpa as we've revisited, relived, and maybe even redefined Phish's storied Fall 97 tour. Welcome to the tour closer.
So this is it? It's over?
Well, that's the voice, if you're wondering, and for those watching on YouTube, the mysterious mustachioed headshot over there of my co-host, Benji Eisen. But Benji, please remain seated until the ride has come to a complete stop. We've got one more to go.
So you're telling me to keep my arms and legs inside the ride at all times?
Yeah, basically, I'm telling you to sit down and relax. We've got the tour closer to go, and we've got something special planned for it. In fact, I have a feeling that for the first time this season, we're going to be focusing on two bands today, Phish and...
King Gizzard.
Thank you. Try again.
Goose.
Nope. Try J. Willis Pratt and We're Bionic.
You know, actually, I have tried them one time, and I'll never forget it. It was actually the night that we're about to speak about. It was quite an unexpected experience. And also, Tom, they are not... J. Willis Pratt and We're Bionic is not a fictional offshoot of Phish, like, say...
Cosmo Voxed.
Your turn to strike out.
Sci-fi soldier.
I'll take Ass Face for 500, Alex. Look, before we go too far off the rails here, I have a special announcement to make. If you've enjoyed this season of Undermine, then it is not too late to join Osiris Premium and keep this party going. It's cheap. It's only a couple bucks. It makes a great holiday gift, and you will get ad-free and bonus episodes of Undermine, HF Pod, access to the Under the Scales archives, meet and greets, and of course more. So check it out, osirispod.com/premium, or just click on the links in the show notes.
Okay, so this is it? It's over?
It's over. We're at Albany, New York, in a building that Deadheads fondly recall as the Knickerbocker Arena. But fans going inside the building on December 13th, 1997, saw signage that declared it the Pepsi Arena. You know, Tom, there is a soft drink joke in there somewhere, but I just don't have it. So it's something about the Pepsi challenge. But enough. Tell us about our guest today, Tom.
Okay, you've made me thirsty, but I thought you'd never ask. Today's guest has something in common with Dave Matthews Band, Modesky Martin and Wood, and the legendary Aquarium Rescue Unit. If you were at Phish's Fall 97 tour closer on December 13th, 1997, in Albany, New York, and I know you were, Benji, and so was I, and so is today's guest, then you might remember that when you entered the arena, there was a surprise opening band on stage. And that band was John Fishman's friend, J. Willis Pratt. And his band is called J. Willis Pratt and We're Bionic. And today's guest is the guitarist, John Kasowitz. These days, he mostly spends his time being a software engineer and a studio music composer. He scores films, I believe. And we should ask him about that. Some of you might know him from another band, Jazz Rockers Raisin Hill. I'm going to bring him in from the green room now. So please welcome John Kasowitz.
Hey, guys.
There he is. Hi, John.
Hey, hi, John. How are you?
Thanks for joining us today. In the intro, you probably couldn't hear because you were in the waiting room. We kind of mentioned that opening that you guys did for the tour closer for Phish's 97 tour, the final night, December 13th, 1997. And it was a special night for Phish fans, but a special night for you. What was the first thing you think of when you look back on this night, John?
I mean, it's so hard not to just put myself back on that stage. We were on the Phish stage. I was standing on Mike's rug in front of his pedal board with his mic stand in front of me, looking out at their crowd and under their lights and through their sound system. It was just incredible. It was unreal, totally surreal. I still can't believe it really happened.
And apart from those bands that I mentioned in the intro, you know, very few bands have opened for Phish, and it's like you count yourself, you know, on one hand, less fingers than on a normal person's hand, I think, have opened for Phish.
Yeah, and for us too. I mean, for me, this was the largest crowd I had ever played up, you know, in front of up until that point and since then. So it's been, you know, it's definitely monumental for me.
Awesome. Let's
back up for 1 second. You know, let's talk about J. Willis Pratt and We're Bionic. You know, for our listeners who might not be familiar with that band, how long were you in them? And just can you tell us about them?
Sure. It's hard to talk about J. Willis Pratt and We're Bionic without first kind of like explaining who J. Willis Pratt is. He's born and raised in Vermont, just has a knack for writing these really catchy songs with hard rock songs with direct messages, strong hooks. I think he hooked the Phish guys pretty early in the 80s. He was friends with them for a long time. But I met him first when I became a student at Goddard. 2 years prior, so probably like early 95, 2 weeks after I came to Goddard, I was looking for musicians to play with, or at least just find out like what the local scene was like. And Willis was the first person that I met. He was somebody that I was introduced to as kind of a local rock star. So he and I had been friends for 2 years. I knew that he had two albums produced by a Fishman. He had played a few gigs here and there. Phish had sat in on drums with him live, but then also definitely in the recordings. I don't even know if I saw Willis perform before we performed in 97. We had been friends for 2 years. I had been a musician separately in other bands, but we had never actually played together, even though we hung out all the time. We were like best friends, but our musical paths didn't necessarily cross until 3 weeks prior to December 13th. When the fateful call came from Fishman. I was actually hanging out with Willis at his apartment. He's like, check this out. Presses play in his answering machine, and it's Fishman. He's like, hey, Willis, talk to the guys. Like, we're psyched. We want you to come down, open for us, Albany or Pepsi Arena in Albany, December 13th. Be there at 3 p.m. We're going to send up a couple passes, put a band together, you know, psyched. Like, that was it. It was like, that was all the information we had back then. I didn't even know where the Pepsi Arena really was. So I turned to Willis and I'm like, you know, put a band together. Like, are you going to do it solo? Like, are you going to put a band together? Because, you know, I don't know who your regular guys are. But listen, like, this is an incredible opportunity. And of course, I would love to participate if you need anybody, guitar player, keyboardist, drummer, whatever. Of course, Fishman is the real and official drummer for We're Bionic. Willis will always tell you that. We've played with lots of other drummers along the way when Fish can't make it, but he's always the first string player in our group. But I literally had to audition for the band at that point. He's like, I'm not so sure. This is a big, important gig for me. I don't know. Like, can you really play? So the first couple of rehearsals were sort of my audition. I think he was into it. I had to borrow somebody's bass. So 3 weeks before I got into the band, 3 weeks later, I'm on stage opening for Fish.
That is called being in the room at the right place at the right time when he pressed play on that message. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really, really cool. I'm surprised that no songs, like another friend of the band, Nancy, you know, wrote Haley's Comet and I Didn't Know. I'm surprised no J. Willis Pratt songs have migrated into the catalog if they're as hooky and catchy as you say. Do you know if they ever have, or has Fish ever played any?
They have not. I've talked to Fishman about this before. I made a few suggestions because I think that it would be thrilling. I've been waiting to see if they would ever bust one out. I think there are definitely a few songs. I mean, Bleeding in a Shark's Tank, his second album, Fishman's playing drums, but both Mike and Trey also appear on several tracks on that album. So they know these tunes. They just have to get it around, I think, and rehearse one and bring it to the stage.
Unless I'm mistaken, I think I've heard J. Willis Pratt's songs played by Fish as DJ when he does The Errant Path.
Yes, that's true.
So I believe some of us may have heard it, whether we know what we were listening to or not. But was this the first time then that you saw Fish, or had you seen Fish prior?
I had seen Fish prior. Not. I feel like not in a while. In 97, I also went actually with Willis to go see them at the Flint Theater in Burlington for the Fish Food Bonanza. And we all walked out with, like, you know, armfuls of pints of Fish Food, which was pretty great. Prior to that, I think my first show was like 93. It was 29. I saw two shows in that 93 New Year's run, one in New Haven and one up in the New Year's show up in Worcester. And then I saw some shows in 94, 95. After that, not too many. Like 96, I went to Clifford Ball. 97, these shows as well. I did show up to Albany a night earlier to check out 1212 and then play it on 1213.
Nice.
So then you were, you know, familiar with Fish for sure. And so you knew back then, of course, that it was, you know, as Tom mentioned, it was a rare occasion when they'd have somebody open for them. I remember they had Baby Gramps in 93. they had Dave Matthews Band in 94. Those guys, I don't know what happened to their career right after that, but then Modesky, Martin and Wood in 1995. And I think that you were the last opener. You know, I don't think that any band has opened again since. So, you know, you just kind of took us back to those moments before when you found out that you'd be opening to Fish in the 3 weeks leading up to it. Was there any interaction? I mean, obviously you have Fish himself, but was there any interaction with the band members leading up to it? Do you remember communication as you were advancing the gig?
No communication just prior to that. I had different interactions with different band members before that, certainly, but nothing like coming up to that gig. We really showed up cold. We didn't even know where to park. Like, one of the cars ended up behind their 16 wheelers, and Brad Sands had to come like running to find somebody's car keys to move the car to get us out of the way. I mean, we were really, really cold and new, and you know, coming into that.
On show day, do you know if they watched the set? Did they talk to you at all about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, Yeah, we got there around 3 or 4 o'clock. We knew that we were supposed to get there early enough for sound check. We first met with Paul Languedoc. He was like, "Where's your stage plot?" We're like, "We're total unprofessionals. We don't have that." we talked about, you know, like the stage setup and the equipment. He saw us lugging in our like pretty, you know, ragged gear. And I love this story because he just looked at it. He took one look at our gear and he's just like, "All right, yeah. Let me go raid the backstage rehearsal room, grab a tray amp and grab a mic amp." And like, you know, "Let's make you guys sound really good for this." I mean, that was, we just felt the warmth immediately. We felt this big hug from like all the crew members that like, we want to do this right. I think there was like one other story that Paul was telling me that when Phish opened for Santana, like they used to only get like a certain part of the mixing board. He's like, "I'm going to give you the whole mixing board for this." And Chris Carota came out to us. He's like, "Do you guys want the full like light show?" We're like, "Yes, absolutely." So we had a full sound check with all these guys. And as we were playing through, I think like 2 or 3 full songs to an empty arena, I looked down and the 4 guys in Phish are front row center sitting watching our sound check. And that was so special. And also, again, like unbelievable. Like, "Oh my God, Phish is now watching me like in their arena." Like, that's wild.
That's great. Was there, I think you might have answered this, but I didn't quite get it. Was there ever a thought that Fishman would play drums for this set?
Yes, I think that there certainly was. And I think, you know, there's still questions in everyone's minds, like, why didn't he just come up and play? I think that, you know, from talking to him, I think it was just like, it didn't feel right to have the opening band and the headliner like have the same drummer. I think he was really hoping we would bring a drummer, and we were kind of secretly hoping he would just, you know, flip off onto the throne and play. But it never happened. So yeah, we opened drummerless in a hard rock band. It was kind of unbelievable.
I have a question that maybe Benji would know as a tape collector. Did the tapers in the room press record for the whole J. Willis Pratt set? And is it on all the Phish tapes or is it not?
It's not on all the Phish tapes. I do have a copy of it, though. I think that Paul might have had a cassette recorder off the board that I have a copy of. And this was also prior to like them having the video camera like on the sound riser or whatever.
Yeah.
But we did have a video. Like Willis brought his like camcorder, and we had a tape of that. And over the years, it just got lost, which is sad. But there are a couple of photos and the recording.
So 25 years ago to the day, you were on stage. And I just want to know, how did the set go? You know, did you pull it off okay? How many songs did you play?
I think like it was a 7 o'clock show or something. And they were like, "Okay, Phish has to hit the stage by 7:45. So you guys are going to go on like around 7 and play for like 30 minutes. And then we'll switch over." So how many songs we played, I haven't counted recently, probably 6 or 7. It was about a 25 minute set. The lights went down. Fishman actually went up and introduced us. So I just remember the crowd sort of being light at that point, because, you know, people were milling around. It was cold outside, so people were inside. But they're out in the hallways and beer lines and stuff. As soon as the lights went down and they heard Fishman's voice, because that was a big deal. Like, it was like, "Oh, something's happening. Like, we don't know what, you know," everyone's looking for that big surprise at a Phish show. So I just remember all of the doorways, the lit up doorways in the arena filling up with people. I could watch people streaming in our entire set. So I think that by the, like, you know, song 3 or 4, we pretty much had a full house.
Well, I was one of those people streaming in. I had heard there was a rumor outside in the like you said, it was cold, and for the Pepsi Arena, the scene kind of spills out into the street, and they close off some of the actual street to traffic. And Tom, I think I may have run into you this night outside. I might be confusing it with another night in Albany, but regardless, I heard the rumor that there was going to be an opening band. And I had actually heard of J. Willis Pratt and Where Beyond It through Phish dorkdom and geekiness and just hearing about the connection and all that. And so I went inside, I caught the set. You know, you just have such an amazing experience of this night. And this night was such an amazing night in Phish history, period. You know, after you, then Phish comes back on stage after a quick set change. and plays a legendary show. So we are going to take our own little set change here, a little set break, and go to a very quick commercial. But don't go anywhere, because when we come back, Phish will take center stage.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's distrokid with a capital K, .com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's distrokid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.
As promised, we are back. We're talking about Phish's 12/13/97 tour closer in Albany, New York, with John Kasowitz, who had the unique experience of opening for the band that night with J. Willis Pratt and We're Bionic. John played guitar, and we were talking about it earlier in this episode before the break. And John pointed out to us that there's a couple of YouTubes where you could see J. Willis Pratt and We're Bionic with Fishman playing drums. And also in the show notes for this episode, we're going to have more of tonight's show, tonight's opener, that you can find. We don't know exactly where it is yet, but check out the show notes. So John, after your set, you walk off stage. Did you interact with any of the Phish band members, or were they kind of getting ready, for their set?
Yeah, we certainly had a lot of time to spend with them, like during dinner and before the show, but it's such a professional environment back there. As many people as were backstage back in those days, the band area is closed off, and you kind of know, you get a sense of like which doors not to go through. So I think that they were preparing themselves for the show right before.
It sometimes helps when you see a huge John Langenstein with his arms folded standing right in front of the one hallway that leads to all the band rooms.
Yeah, I remember that clearly.
Well, let's dive into the show. The first set doesn't look, looking back on it all these years later, 25 years later, it doesn't look super remarkable on paper. But of course, that's part of the story of Phish and of this tour, is that the set list never tells the tale. You know, there are a lot of unexpected first set, first song jams this tour. This was one of them. It was an unusual 18-minute jammed out Yamar. It had an immediate Cal Funk flavor to it, which was kind of the staple of the tour. John, can you just kind of take us through the first set?
Both sets, I sort of saw in like three acts. So set one, act one, starts with this big Yamar, maybe the longest ever. I don't know for a fact, but the fact that this Yamar ends where it typically ends after like that, you know, there's a drum bit break in this one, and then like the typical sort of guitar solo, little noodly guitar solo. And then Trey comes back in with that opening riff, but like 20 beats per second slower. I don't know if that was intended or not, but it's slower. And then it shifts to like the parallel minor key. So it's like, you know, so then they shift into this like slower minor funk jam for like 10 minutes. It's unbelievable. Like I just didn't see it coming. I do remember this live because I was standing with my parents. They were like fifth row center at this show. This was their first Phish experience ever. And after this 18 minute EMR, they turned to me. They're like, John, like we had such a fun time tonight, but we have to go.
You've almost given us, this is a theme, a common theme where someone is bringing someone who doesn't know Phish to Phish during these 97 shows. And often their experience is, what just happened to me? We should almost have a podcast about bringing people to Phish.
that's very funny. So to continue on, so Yamar and then Axilla follows that. And what's interesting about this is that as much as Trey slowed down the ending of Yamar, he speeds up Axilla. I don't know how it started so quickly, but they all come in, and I think they very, you know, they like very soon after that they do slow down to like the typical tempo of that song. But that's what, that's the original lyrics and part two's ending. I don't know if that was like a common thing back then, but I don't know. Anyway, Axilla and then Theme from the Bottom, which is like a nice kind of cool down after all that jamming. That to me is like act one, because, you know, it's kind of all over the place. There are lots of different feels. The songs are decently long. There are jams in each one. And then we go right into act two, which is like, Mike sings, Paige sings, Trey sings, three very, very kind of like short traditional Phish tunes, where I wish that my parents saw this part of the first set. They would probably understand it a lot more. But Ginseng Sullivan, Strange Design. It's always like when Strange Design starts, I'm like, oh, Paige. Like, I love hearing Paige sing. It's always like, you know, such a nice breather in a set. And Sample in a Jar, pretty like standard, I would say. I don't think they jammed it out too hard. And then like that, to me, this is now going to act three, Vultures, which was a song I never heard of before that night. That was a brand new song for me. I think that was also like a bust out for the tour, right?
They debuted Vultures that summer. It was it's a 97 tune, and it's part of the Califunk family of tunes, you know, with Ghost as well. And what's interesting this night is that it's not a typical Vultures, and that even though it gets grouped with the Califunk sound in that era, but at the same time, this Vultures, it kind of devolves in the middle of it a little bit. And like you're saying, you know, the tempos that Trey was, you know, kind of messing with early on in the set, to me that inside this Vultures, he kind of does that, and that it almost... And I use this not in a way of like it falls apart, but not like in a way that's like it intentionally falls apart. And then they kick right back into that end of Vultures. And now when they go into that end of Vultures, it's a woo moment and it's a funky moment. Here it was more like the arena rock that they were playing in 96.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I definitely like recognize that it was falling apart in that like sort of free noise jam thing. I did some research about Vultures because it's a song I'm really not that familiar with, but it did sound like they sort of re-orchestrated it or came up with a new sort of pattern of that middle section after that.
You brought up Axilla and the other lyrics. I've never really asked Trey in recent times about this and like his preference, but I think It's Hoist, right? I think when that came out, they kind of bowed a little bit to some pressure about just how goofy the Axilla lyrics were, and but that they like the rock aspect. And I guess this is Elektra talking. You know, could you change it up? Could you change the lyrics? And so I remember Trey and I having to come up with alternate lyrics, which I think when Trey went back to the original lyrics, he's kind of thumbing his nose at establishment, sort of, at least in this early era, 97. But now, unusually, it's become sort of a bust out, you know, hearing the part two, which is strange, but
it's interesting. I didn't know that history. That's really amazing. I just can't believe how many words Trey can remember, and the fact that he can switch between two sets of lyrics for the same song. That blows my mind.
Trey and Paige, I think, have this incredible gift where they see lyrics and then they just know them, and they know that, you know, into every band's catalog too. Like they know all Beatles lyrics, they know all Led Zeppelin lyrics. I've never seen him like rooting around for lyrics, and he just knows. And I'm a lyricist, right? And I love the Beatles. There's like Beatles lyrics I didn't know. It's like, what are you singing? And it's like, oh my God, that's what they're saying. You know, where he just always knows them. And I've seen him do it with my lyrics. I bring him, you know, 20 poems, and he kind of does this thing at the beginning of a writing session where he's going through all of them. And then, you know, maybe 2 hours later, he's kind of playing something on guitar, and he'll go, can you tell me that one about the boat again? And I'll be like, what? You know, and he'll remember that there was one, you know, about, you know, X, Y, or Z that I completely don't know anything about. And he'll even say like part of the lines back to me. It's uncanny. And that's how they can do it. That's how they can have 500 songs in their repertoire.
That is amazing.
Yeah, really, really amazing. Benji, should we go into set two?
Before that, I think, John, you're saying about the three acts, and I'm curious to hear how the tube plays into it, because the tube on this night was a very funky tube.
Yeah, it was. And I think that's where I started to recognize that, like, Paige on clavinets, like this sound, this new Fish sound, like he was replacing a lot of like organ parts that he used to play on organ, like in tube or whatever. Now, like heavy, heavy clavinet style, which brought me back to that, you know, just like the Stevie Wonder sound of the 70s. Like, I loved it. So that's just like my remark on tube, that it was just like funky, semi-ambient, but a lot of clavinet. Yeah, super awesome. And then Good Times, Bad Times. To me, that's like maybe a little nod to Willis, like a little like hard rock nod. I wish they would bring the Kiss song back. I know that that Willis and Fishman often argue about Kiss, but Fish did play Kiss once, didn't they? Like, I was hoping for the bust out there.
Detroit Rock City, right?
Yeah, here's the question. There's a story about Fishman and J. Willis Pratt going to a Kiss concert. I think that's probably for another time, but it's a legendary story.
It's a pretty legendary story. And Trey, I think, was also a part of that that journey.
You know, you can tell that story because it's interesting if you know it.
Well, I mean, I can paraphrase it. There's an interview with Fishman and me for Relics magazine like a couple of years ago, and I think that he talks about it more. But basically, short story, they sort of kidnap Willis from work one day, Trey and Fishman, to surprise him for his birthday, to bring him to his favorite rock band concert, Kiss, down in Worcester or whatever, and you know. A lot of fun on the way down during the show and the way back. It's a pretty remarkable story. You need to hear Fishman tell this story because he's excellent at it.
You know what? Another thing we'll do in addition to posting some of the music is we can post a link to that Relics article, because it's definitely entertaining.
Yeah.
Note to self, got a lot of show notes to write for this show, Benji. let's discuss Fame 2, set 2, the famous Bring the Dude set, Bring in the Dude. And do you have any, let's do it in order. What do you think about set two, John?
Set two, again, I see in three acts. So like act one, NICU, just a note on that. Like, I think is it Trey that says play it Leo, or screams play it Leo? They did that at the beginning of set one and at the beginning of set two. I thought that was kind of cool. Punch in the eye, solid standard version. Ghost, it felt a little slower to me. Maybe it's just like the beat, the swing was a little bit different. Like it was just a more funky version than I was used to. And again, a lot of clavinet, and another funk jam. For sure. It's kind of sort of felt like the Yamar jam was like the foreshadowing of the Ghost jam.
Nice.
In this concert. So that was act one. Act two is this Mike song, the legendary Bring On The Dude. I thought it was at the moment, I thought it was Bring On The Dude, Bring In The Dude, or Change Into Bring In The Dude.
I don't think they knew necessarily. I think it's bring in the dude. And they're all saying it. And it almost became, it's hilarious when you hear this mics. And like, cause Trey will say something like, all right, Paige, I'm going to bring in the dude. And then everyone goes quiet and Trey, it's almost like a way of announcing that you want the spotlight briefly for yourself. And then he has Paige bring in the dude. It's like, doesn't make any sense. And yet, can you shed any light on what the heck was going on with the dude?
It starts, stop jams, you know, but yeah, announced stop, start jams.
Yeah.
I mean, is there any other context that, because I'm curious, because I do have my own sort of perspective and opinion of it, but I don't know if it's already been explained on the internet, you know, like that, like what this was all about.
It struck a little memory chord in me just as we were talking about prepping for this show, but I'd like to hear what you know.
And then okay. I want to hear what you know, Tom.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was my perspective. I did have a laminate all access pass for the show. So I was able to go anywhere and everywhere. I was wandering around every song. I was kind of like going into a new section or a new place that like I knew I wasn't ever allowed to go, like between the, you know, like the front rail and the stage, and just kind of squeezing in there and watching Trey from like five feet away. So being backstage and being around, I know that Steve, the dude of life, was there. Like he was backstage, he was hanging out with the band. I had met Steve, you know, prior to that night. So, you know, we were kind of friendly with each other. So when I was, I think when they started Mike's song, I was like right on the side of the stage, like by the stairs or something. And you can hear it in the recording, like they're kind of talking on stage, like they're like before anybody like yells, bring on the dude or bring in the dude, there's kind of like conversations. And I had the sense that they were summoning the dude of life. Like they wanted Steve to come on stage and maybe do like a Crimes of the Mind or something in between Mike's song and Weak Pod. When I saw them, whenever they started saying like bring the dude, I ran backstage and was like, where's Steve? I have to find the dude. Like he's like, they want him on stage. And so during this whole mic song, I think I was like running around the arena looking for Steve, and I couldn't find him. And I finally found him at the end of the night, and he's like, what? I didn't hear it. So it was kind of like a letdown in that way. But at 3 minutes into it or 4 minutes into it, after you know, Trey brings the dude, I think twice, he's like, I'm going to bring it again or bring him in again. I think it's Mike into the microphone that says of life.
Yeah.
So Mike, they are talking about dude of life.
Before
you tell us your story, which may have some insider information, I don't know, but I will tell you from the 100 session, looking down on it that night, I have this vivid memory of John. It's also amazing to hear your perspective, because I kind of have the counterpoint to that, where as a fan in the audience, front of house without any credentials, and I hear Bryn the Dude, and I saw Steve earlier milling about outside, so I knew he was in the building, and I was getting anxiety about it. I was like, oh my God, somebody has to go get the dude. They're calling for him. And then I felt like it almost felt like they were kind of, when they realized that maybe he might not make it to the stage, that's when Trey's like, I'm going to bring the dude, and then goes into the stop start jam. Tom, what was your perspective on it?
All right. So my perspective is, first of all, well, it's interesting you say Steve hadn't heard that, because I was going to say, if he heard it, you don't have to ask Steve twice to come on stage. There would be no need to run around and push him on stage. He loves being on stage. And if he had heard Bring On the Dude, he would have just come on whether or not they're talking about him. So my perspective is that the night before, or sometime during that tour, and I think I may have been there, I believe they were making fun of Mike for bringing a dude that they didn't know to some, either a party or some event. They were expecting Mike, and he asked for an extra guest. I could be embellishing a little bit, but for whatever it was, Mike showed up with a guy that none of the band knew, and they were kind of making fun of him, like, that dude, Mike's with that dude. And so, like, on the bus, Phish can be brutal, really brutal. I've been the target of it. They were calling him Dude Bringer, and so. You know, of course it comes out the next day, you know, they, and I don't think it was the dude of life, but Mike, possibly to divert or to just add to the joke, said of life, because he probably knew Steve's there. So okay. I don't think the dude is the dude.
That's interesting. I think, like, the lyric too, like, you know, big dude in the doorway or whatever, like there's something that Trey kind of does, like a response to that. So the, yeah, I mean, then I think he says, like, you shall bring the dude, Michael, or something like that. That you're right. It could totally relate to that story. That's great.
And it's Mike's song, so that's when he's supposed to bring the dude.
But he's the dude bringer.
Yeah, he's the dude bringer. John, let's plow forward with this set.
What's up?
Let's move forward with this set. So in the Mike song, it's the Bring the Dude Mike song, and then it goes into a llama, which is like the Vultures. It's a very unusual llama as well.
Super fast, right? And then it breaks down as some kind of like slow swinging guitar jam, and then back into the I guess the singing and finishing the song super quick.
Just like the Vultures, there's this moment where it kind of devolves and feels like it's falling apart, and then it goes right back into it. Amazing.
Yeah, that's cool. It is amazing. And then When the Circus Comes to Town, kind of, you know, love the cover, just a pretty standard version, I think. And then Weak Pog. And then that kind of, you know, somehow ends up in Catapult and then back to Weakabog. So there is that theme there, you're right, of kind of, you know, devolving into something and then coming back into it. But I mean, again, to me, my mind, end of Act Two, and probably could have been a fine end of show. We already had a lot of music that night, but then they go into this huge Harry Hood, right? Like a 17, 18 minute long Harry Hood. And I don't quite remember all the details of this. I mean, I may have, like, not even, I don't know where I was at this point, like in the arena, but so I can hear the audience erupting several times, but I'm unable to see what's happening. So yeah. I don't know, Benji, if you remember.
Yeah, you may have been in the clinic or something at that moment.
Yeah, I might have been.
I remember because they were doing these, you know, it started at the Gorge, I believe, the year before, in 96, where Kuroda would turn off the lights and there was what, you know, the fans called the glow stick war. And Trey from the stage asked Kuroda to turn the lights off, and therefore encouraging the fans to, you know, just like the dude doesn't need to be told twice, you don't need to tell the guy sitting on, you know, in the aisle seat in 102 to throw a glow stick. He's been waiting for it a whole night. And so that was their time to shine. So there's a little glow stick war in there, which also, you know, the band kind of plays along to as well. Kind of like with the Big Ball Jam, where the band is literally playing the visuals that they're seeing in the arena, in the fishbowl, as it were.
John, that's where we met. we were in the clinic during Harry Hood, and we both turned to each other and said, "What the hell's going on out there?"
Yeah. Should we go out and see? Nah. No, I'm kidding. But I was going to say, I was probably still looking for Steve. But I love Harry Hood. And this one's an interesting one. I mean, just because of that ambience, it's just, the build is kind of like, tweaked a bit. I mean, it's such a long, long, long ambient section. But still beautiful and a nice way to end this, I'm sure, this whole tour. I mean, like, besides that, there's also the encore, but, Trey does sort of, say something at the end of Harry of just like, thank you so much. We had a great time this tour. And that was a nice moment.
Well, it was an incredible night. With your experience, I'm sure it's a night you'll never forget.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. What a great night. It sounds like exciting for, it was exciting for all of us. I loved it. And I did remember walking in and seeing you guys. So it was good to kind of finally meet you and get to talk about it. That's really cool. So that's going to do it for today. That's a wrap on Fall 97 and thus a wrap on season 4 of Undermine.
Aren't you forgetting something, Tom?
Well, it was supposed to be a surprise.
Well, you mean like in the same way that like an encore at the end of a 2-set show is a surprise?
I guess so. Exactly. But so we'll take a bow now, but then we'll be back with a special encore episode on Friday. That's the surprise. So big round of applause for our guest today, John Kasowitz. Thanks, John. And thanks to both of my co-hosts this season, Benji Eisen and RJB. And together with Brian Brinkman, you have the Undermine Executive Producing Squad. And thanks to our entire Osiris team, especially Eric Limarenko and Matt Dwyer, for making all of this work from behind the scenes. And we couldn't do it without them, and we wouldn't do it without you. So thank you for listening. And please rate us, follow us, engage with us on social media and all the other things to keep in touch during the holiday break. Have a great YMSG, never change, and we'll be back.
On Friday.
Yes, that's right. Of course. On Friday, Benji. And after that, for season 5. And one last thing, if you're looking for tickets, I might be able to help you out for Phish at Madison Square Garden this New Year's or at any show, then check out Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. Check them out at cashortrade.org. It's been a great tour. We'll see you around the bend. And until then, be safe and we love you. Thanks, John. Thank you, Benji.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Tom.
Hey, Undermine listeners, watchers, fans, people. Tom and I couldn't end this season without one more thank you. And I guess first I'll just say again, thank you to all of you listeners, because I wasn't on the last episode, but we really appreciate everyone's support and participation and listening along to the shows and all that. We have one person on our team who we haven't thanked. We've thanked Matt and Eric and Benji and Tom and myself. I've thanked myself a lot. But we have one person who we haven't thanked yet. And if you're watching this or listening to this and you interact with us on any social media platform, you probably interact with this person every day. And he's the voice of Osiris. He's the public voice. He's helped build this community around this show and around this brand. And we absolutely would not be where we are today without him.
That person is Nick Sejas, and I'm going to say it on behalf of RJ, myself, Benji, and Osiris. Thank you, Nick, so much for all your hard work. And if you interact with Osiris online or in any form, you're often interacting directly with Nick. And Nick is the reason we sound funny, have a sense of humor, are up to date on current events. He is just a fount of knowledge, and he is the public voice of Osiris. And we wouldn't be where we are without Nick. So thank you so much, Nick. And thank everyone else. Have a glorious holiday. And this season has been amazing, and thanks so much for tuning in.
Thank you.
Osiris.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lambgoat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lambgoat's Van Flip Podcast.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room.
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11. Oh.